Good afternoon. Welcome to Baird Hall, room 250, for today's conversation with Professor Charles Ogletree. And before we begin, President Chaprathi would like to provide a welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us today. Today at the University at Buffalo, we are honored to host a very distinguished guest, Professor Charles Ogletree. Jesse Klimenko, Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, and the founding and executive director of the Harvard's Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice. Professor Ogletree is a prominent legal theorist, lawyer, and a public intellectual who is known around the world for his work related to issues of race, equity, and social justice. Later this evening, he will deliver the 40th annual Martin Luther King Jr. commemoration address as part of UB's Distinguished Speaker Series. Right now, we have the valuable opportunity to spend some time talking more closely with Professor Ogletree as part of a small group discussion. He has kindly agreed to spend some time with us today, sharing his perspective as one of the nation's leading voices on civil rights, race, justice, and educational opportunity. These issues are deeply relevant to the higher education community here at Buffalo and across the nation. And universities like ours provide a powerful forum for discussing issues of such great consequence. In recent months, colleges and universities across the U.S. have been the site of intense national debate about issues of race, equity, and inclusion. As a nation, and certainly here on our own UB campus, we have been grappling together with big and difficult questions about how to foster a safe, inclusive and welcoming campus climate for all, about how to balance this ideal with the principles of academic freedom and freedom of expression, and about new ways to approach race, ethnicity, and cultural difference from the academic curriculum to the way we think about campus operations. Today, we are very fortunate to have the opportunity to continue this dialogue with a leading voice in the national conversation about race, social justice, and inclusiveness, Professor Charles Ogletree. This afternoon, Professor Ogletree will sit down with UB's own Bert Gambini. Bert has been a member of the UB community for nearly 25 years, most recently in his role in university communications. Previously, he spent more than two decades working in Buffalo Radio, including 18 years as a program host on NPR member station WBFO. During his time at WBFO, Bert hosted many memorable on-air conversations with some of the leading thinkers of our time. We're delighted he is continuing in that great tradition as he sits down with Professor Ogletree today. Please join me now in welcoming Professor Charles Ogletree speaking with Bert Gambini.
Professor, please. Well, President Chaprathi, again, thank you and welcome Professor Ogletree. It's a pleasure to have this opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. For our audience, you'll have a chance to take part in our discussion as well when we open the floor to audience questions. If you'd like to participate, you can let us know just by raising your hand, and we'll make sure that somebody gets a microphone to you. Professor, your undergraduate studies at Stanford represent an education that was shaped by experiences both inside and outside of the classroom. What is it that initially attracted you to Stanford?
Well, I think the thing that really attracted me first was the person that I met there on my first day at Stanford University, my wife, Pam Ogletree. And 4 years later, we were married, and God bless us. We had two children, a son who turns 40 today, and a daughter who's 36 years old. And we have four granddaughters. I'm just looking for anybody that has a grandson. I just want one, right? One, just one, right? That'll be enough. But, you know, it's been a wonderful opportunity. I was head of the Black Students Union. I was involved in politics at the university. And I didn't even realize how much we had to endure at Stanford. And the reality is that I was close to San Francisco and Oakland. I spent my weekends going to San Francisco and Oakland. And I am not, even though Glenn Beck believes differently, I am not a member of the Black Panther Party. I love the Black Panthers. They did a great job for me, and we have them come and speak many times, but I'm not a member of the organization. But it was nice to see a nonviolent group responding to police conduct, and that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit today.
You know, you entered college just as a generation of students was coming of age in the years after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, and then you entered Harvard Law School at a time when Brown was facing its greatest challenge. This is a profound confluence of events, and how did it shape you that you were a student at both of these historical junctures?
It was very challenging. When I was leaving Stanford, I got my bachelor's degree, and I stayed on the fourth year to get my master's degree. Neither my parents, my mother nor my father, neither of them finished high school. And so for me, I was the first person in the family to go on to high school, going to college, going to graduate school. And it made a big difference to me. And when I thought about it, all the things that happened at Stanford were, in a sense, much of what was happening at Harvard. And I was saying, I'm not going to go to Harvard. I'm going to stay in California. But my wife said, Charles, you can't do the work, right? I said, yeah, I can do the work. Yeah. I said, well, then you need to go to Harvard. So I went to Harvard, and I graduated from there, and I was getting ready to come back home to California. And the dean said, no, why don't you stay and join our faculty? I said, well, I'm going to go to Washington practice for a while. And I went and practiced for many years at the Public Defender Service in Washington, D.C.
And you say that's your true calling, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Mentioned that in all deliberate speech.
That made a big difference to me, and I thought I was going to be there forever. And the dean was asking me to come, please come to Harvard, come to Harvard, come to Harvard to teach. And Jim Vorenberg has passed away, God rest his soul. But I was very happy with the Public Defender Service. I was very happy with Washington, D.C., very happy with my family. And I thought I was going to stay in Washington. And it was my wife that convinced me to go to Harvard. When I first hit my letter from Harvard, she found it and she said, you know, you're going to Harvard. Yeah. And she went to the business school at Harvard, and I went to the law school at Harvard. And I've been teaching ever since then.
Would you discuss the historical significance of the phrase that is the title of your book, All Deliberate Speed?
You know, it's very interesting. It's actually a quote from the 1954 decision, Brown versus Board of Education, by one of the justices. And Thurgood Marshall was then arguing the case, Brown versus Board of Education, how important it was for opportunity for education. And the justice says, well, we're going to talk about race and talk about integrated schools, but we have to do it with all deliberate speed. And to my view, that meant no speed at all, and as I talk about it in the book. And that's why I had the title of the book, so All Deliberate Speed, and how slow it was to make it possible for all of us to be part of the community. Black, brown, yellow, red, the color, the race doesn't matter at all, I think. And I think that opened a lot of opportunities. And, you know, when you think about it, you think about places like Stanford, places like Harvard, they're private institutions. But, you know, you think about it, one of my favorite students, I should say my most favorite student is his wife, Michelle Obama, but President Barack Obama. And you know, as much as he's had a tough time being president, and now as he's in his second term, I campaigned for him. I was an advisor to him. I made it happen. And I was also very active in Jesse Jackson Sr.'s campaign. And his son, Jesse Jackson Jr., who was had some problems. But, you know, it was very interesting to support Obama and what it meant. And the last thing that people understood, we went, he won Iowa, where they had the caucuses. Hillary Clinton, he lost to Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. And then he won in South Carolina. And then, you know, made the country, made it happen. It's very interesting when you think about South Carolina, what won for him, and it hates for me to say this, it's not him, it's Michelle Obama. She came there and people said, wow, that's a black woman. She's great. She's the first lady. And when he came in, they said, who are you? He said, you know, I'm her husband. And they said, oh, okay. Then what do you do? We said, well, I'm the president of the United States. I'm running for president of the United States. And so they finally elected him, but she's been a terrific person, and I've been trying to campaign for her to make her run for president of the United States of America. She refuses. She said, well, my children are in high school. My children are young, and now both their girls are grown, and they're going to colleges. And I said, Michelle, now you can run. But now she's not going to run.
And you mentioned the Obamas. You've said before that when you first met, you knew that this was going to be the first African-American president. But you actually weren't right. You were talking about Michelle.
Right. I was right because I thought that she would be the first African-American president because she was so bright. She was very active on the civil side at Harvard, very dressed nicely. And she treated her clients, and mainly women, poverty, with respect and dignity. And that, to me, stood out. And I said, she's going to be the first president, black president. She had no interest in running for office. And so,
Where do you see her career going after January of 2017?
I'm still pushing for her to run for president of the United
States
of America.
Well, she said she doesn't want to do that.
She said that. She said it many times. I keep saying it to her. I see her every single year at the White House. I see her on Martha's Vineyard. I said, Michelle, you've got to run. And I have pictures of her around my office. I said, you know, you've got to run for president of the United States because she's learned, got her bearings together. And she's done an outstanding job from my point of view.
For those watching online, this is an archived conversation with Professor Charles Ogletree. He is the Harvard Law School Jesse Clemenko Professor of Law and the founding and executive director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice. Professor Ogletree is the University at Buffalo's 40th annual Martin Luther King Jr. commemoration keynote speaker. This conversation took place the afternoon before the professor's lecture as part of UB's Distinguished Speaker Series. For more information about the university, you can visit our website at buffalo.edu. Professor, you had mentioned violence that we're seeing now, constant in the news. But the violence we're witnessing is certainly not new. Yet there's a heightened level of awareness and there's a heightened level of activism. What's fueling that?
What's interesting is that we've always had violence around our country. And I grew up with violence around me. I grew up in 1952 in Merced. We had a leader then. His name was Martin Luther King Jr. His death was an example of violence and how important it was. And I learned about him. And I met Thurgood Marshall, like I said, and how important it was to meet him, have a conversation with him to talk about what we're going to do. I introduced him to my wife. I went to the Supreme Court. And I said, well, you know, this is my wife, Pam. We've been married for a long time. He says, well, are you boasting or complaining? I said, you know, he's a jokester. You know, he's always cracking a joke. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the reality was that I was very happy to have her with me to show how much it meant to her and how much it meant to me to have somebody like Thurgood Marshall in the Supreme Court.
Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, we're talking about the victims that we've seen over the last few years. These are all men. What about the women who have died as a result of police violence? Are Are they being ignored? Is the memory being ignored?
You know, what's interesting, one of my former students, who's now is a professor at both in New York and in California, UCLA and at Columbia, she has written about women in particular. And I think that we need to understand how important a role that women have played. Women have lost their lives. The same thing, going out, being arrested by police or harassed by police and killed. And these are mothers of children. It's very sad. And I think that we need to talk more about that. And my next book is talking about women in particular, because they are a forgotten legacy about how much we've had to endure.
Tanisha Anderson in 2014, Miriam Carey in 2013, Kayla Moore also in 2013. You write about the 1970 student activism in All Deliberate Speed. How does that time compare with student activism that we see today?
The thing about it is it's more integrated, which is good, and it's more profound, which is good, and it's also more national and global than it was when I was a student. There's a whole lot of students who preceded me at Stanford and at Harvard, and how much it meant for them to recruit for more diverse faculty, more diverse students, more diverse staff, and that made a big difference. Those are my heroes and sheroes when I think about the people who've made a big difference in my life. I have to say that watching them made all the difference in the world. And when you think about it and you see signs of that, you see it around the universities, around Stanford, you see it around universities, around Harvard, you see some of the portraits of people who've made an amazing difference. And the thing that made a big difference for me was, I don't know how many people here know the former head of the Maryland Court of Appeals, he's a state court judge, Robert Bell. He was the first person that went out to recruit a black faculty member. And he went with Derek Bach, the president of Harvard University, and then formerly the dean of Harvard Law School. And they went out to California, of all places, to recruit Derek Bell. And Derek Bell came to teach at Harvard Law School. And his first goal was what? We want more women on the faculty who are women of color. And Derek Bell was keen about that. And he says, I'm going to leave Harvard unless Harvard hires some women of color. And I said to him, I'm not tenured, Professor Bell, but I'm ready to leave to you. I've got some experience. I'm a lawyer. I know how to try a case. So I'm prepared to resign. He says, no, stay and get your tenure at Harvard, you can do what you want to do. And Derek Bell's passed away, but his wife, Janet Bell, has been a civil rights leader no matter what. And he's married. His first wife died, and he passed away. But his certain wife, Janet Bell, is doing a great job.
President Tripathi mentioned freedom of expression and an inclusive campus climate in his opening remarks. And you're aware of the controversial student art project at UB last fall, which actually began a debate on negotiating the boundaries between mm-hmm. those two. And it's a conversation happening not only on this campus, but on campuses across the country as well. Where is the balance between those two ideals? How do we find it?
And I may be the wrong person to speak on this, but my view is this, that I believe that students have every right to the freedom of speech, and they should say what they want to say and do what they want to do. The same thing that's happened here has happened at the campuses around the country. When we think about it, it happened at Harvard. Although the people didn't identify themselves as, you know, black or brown or Black Lives Matter, what group they were a part of, but we saw tape over black faculty members, tenured black faculty, over their faces. The day after that, I was amazed and surprised and pleased. Faculty, students, staff around the university came and put up little signs. We need you. We want you. We love you. And I think that was a rebellion against whoever did it. And And the dean of Harvard Law School, I love her to death, Martha Minnell. She's a little younger than I am. But she wants to punish the students who put the black tape over that. And I said, Martha, I don't think the students should be punished. I think we should have a dialogue with them. She said, no, they need to be sent to jail. I said, no, I think we need to have a dialogue to talk about why they did it. They did it for a reason, and we need to understand the reason. And she said, well, do you have some familiarity with that? Well, I didn't speak about that. Yes, I did have some familiarity with that. That is exactly what students do to make people understand diversity makes a big difference in staff and faculty and students all around the university.
And that dialogue that you mentioned with the students, you've talked about the importance of conversation, but not necessarily group. I mean, one-on-one conversation. Yep. And the value that it has. I want to take this from your book, All Deliberate Speed. Although in the South, colleges, universities, and graduate schools had been the site of the initial battle over equalization, by the 1970s, many of these establishments had become engines for integration. We see what higher education did in the past. What role can higher education play today with race relations?
I think it plays, from my point of view, it plays a key role. When I think about my hometown, my home city of Merced, how backwards it was. There was a place for the black and brown communities, poor in Merced, and then a place for the white communities. There was a South Merced where the black and brown people live, and the North Merced where the whites live. And everything was built on the north side, schools, restaurants, buildings, theaters, wherever you wanted to go. And I think the statute of limitation has passed. Let me check and see and just make sure. But I remember going to the theater, and my parents had to sit in the balcony because only Negroes could sit in the balcony. They couldn't sit down in the places. I love sitting in the balcony, because I could be in the balcony and I could throw down JBs and any kind of candy at anybody down below, and they didn't know who did it, right? And I didn't, and I kept, I was just, enjoying the movie, right? And that was the great movie. And I think that that was a sign of how it's changed, how things have changed in Merced and changed around the world. The theaters are integrated. I go to movies. It drives my wife crazy. I go to movies every single week. And I try to go to a movie at 7 o'clock or 5 o'clock or 3 o'clock or when I'm on sabbatical particularly. I try to go at least once a week to see what's happening, because that tells you a little bit about what's happening. And I think most people have seen Straight Out of Compton. I saw it when it first came out, and we saw it. My wife has a copy of it. We watch it over and over again. But what was happening in Compton was happening around the country. People were, in a sense, upset with the status quo. They wanted to change it.
Creating leaders, obviously, is among the roles of higher education, and remembering those leaders is the role of history. The Brown decision and its legacy can't be removed from the contributions of Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. and Thurgood Marshall. But is history adequately remembering Marshall?
I don't think so. And I've been writing a lot about Marshall, and even more about Marshall, the new book that I'm writing, because I think it gives you a sense about how important this person was. And it took a long time. And he wasn't a race man in the sense that he only thought race mattered. But, his best friend on the Supreme Court was the Chief Justice, was a white male, right? And the reality was that he had a good dialogue with him. And, and I went to see him, and he said, why didn't you clerk for me? I said, well, there's no excuse, Junior. You clerk for me. I said, well, the reality is that he had good friends on the Supreme Court. And he learned how, after he was on the Supreme Court for a longer period of time, to write dissents. He said, I hire my clerks if they want to write dissents. I write dissents before the cases are even received. I just know I'm going to be in the minority, so I'm going to write a dissent. And occasionally he would have an opinion that people would agree with and would find him. And the reality is that I wish that somebody like him would replace him, but that hasn't happened yet.
And on a similar theme, you're the founder and executive director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. Can you share with us who was Houston and what role did he play in the litigation effort to dismantle segregation?
Absolutely. Houston was born in the 1800s, and he went to Amherst College. There's a Houston Institute at Amherst and a building named after his credit. At Howard, there's a building named after him and Thurgood Marshall. In Maryland, there's a building named after Thurgood Marshall. But, you know, it's very interesting that Houston had the sense that he was going to take people to see what the South was like. And he took Thurgood Marshall, who was a student. He was educated at Harvard Law School after he went to Amherst. He was educated at Harvard Law School and went back to Washington to practice, to be a very successful lawyer. And I think that he taught Thurgood Marshall a lot. And the first thing they wanted to do was change the laws in Virginia, of all places. And I didn't even realize that Virginia was one of those closed states as a kid. But it was very closed with African-American, very little participation. But I remember they couldn't stay at a hotel. They couldn't go to a restaurant. They couldn't stay any place that they wanted to go to that was designed for whites. And so they would eat in their car and sleep in their car because they couldn't travel around the South. But they were committed to, you know, in the classroom, let me teach you criminal law, let me teach you civil procedure, let me teach courts, but let me teach you the practice of what it means. And Charles Hamilton Houston was a vehicle for that. And the first thing when I came to Harvard and I got tenure, they're saying, you know, do you want to start a program? I said, yep. What you want to call it? I said, I want to call it the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice. I never met him, but I met his son. He was the one who opened doors for Thurgood Marshall, opened doors for all of us, even though he had passed away. And if you go around Harvard today, you'll see signs of Charles Hamilton Houston. You'll see him in my office. You see Thurgood Marshall in my office. You see Barack Obama. I have all pictures of folks in my office. They taught me how, as a lawyer, to use my skills to be someone who's going to make a difference. One of the things that I got involved in when I was a young lawyer, younger than I am now, was going to Tulsa, Oklahoma, because there was an enormous amount of difference. And that was an example of separate but equal, right? You know, I said, okay, we'll have the black community. We'll have our own barbershop, our own doctors, our own clinics, our own nurses, you know, and we'll keep away from the white folks. And that seemed fine in Tulsa for a while. And then there was a race riot that happened, and that's what brought me to Tulsa. And now we're going to the United Nations. For the first time, they granted just last week a right for us to bring a lawsuit for reparations on behalf of the Tulsa race riot survivors. And those folks I'm talking about are folks from 1929. They're over 100 years old now. It's very wonderful to have something that you're doing, that we're doing. And I had a bunch of my friends, former public defenders, former attorneys that I met in Washington, former attorneys that I met in Arkansas. Wherever I met lawyers, they joined me, and we went to Tulsa. And it took a very long time for anything to happen. But you know what? It happened. And I think that gives us a sense that if you're willing to make the commitment, it will happen. And that's what we're willing to do.
Are we hearing enough about diversity, equity, justice in the current presidential campaign?
You know, it's rarely mentioned. And I'm not going to be negative about Donald Trump. I don't vote for him. I just want to be clear. Yeah. And Hillary Clinton has a lot of my money. Let me be clear. And Bernie Sanders is a terrific candidate for the Democrats. It'll be very interesting to see who's the president. And it goes back and forth. The Democrats have it for a while. The Republicans have it for a while. And I've had the opportunity to work in with both administrations when Clinton was the president, when Barack Obama was the president, is the president now. And I'll still be active in some respects trying to make some money for them. I think that it's time. You know, it's 2016. We need a woman as president of the United States of America. It's time. It's more than time. It's time for us to move forward to think about women. And I think that bringing her in would be the first step in the right direction. We've had women try it before with much little success. And I know another person who I convinced that she, I'm trying to get her to run for president, but she ran for Senate. She's been elected twice. And she's from Massachusetts, too, Elizabeth Warren. Her husband works with me at Harvard Law School. She's a terrific professor. We have her seat reserved whenever she wants to come back to Harvard, 75, 80 years old, 85. She can come whenever she wants to come. But she's doing a great job in Washington, D.C. as a progressive Democrat leading the battle. Even though the Democrats have lost the House and the Senate as well.
I'd like to open our discussion now to the audience. If you have a question for Professor Ogletree, please raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. And once you have that mic, if you would stand, please say whether you're a guest, faculty member, staff, or student, members of the UB community as well, if you would let us know your school or unit. Again, for those watching online, this is an archive conversation with Professor Charles Ogletree. He is the University at Buffalo's 40th annual Martin Luther King Jr. commemoration keynote speaker. This conversation taking place before the professor's lecture this evening as part of UB's Distinguished Speaker Series. Again, there's more information available online at buffalo.edu. Let's open the floor to questions. For the professor.
Hi. My name is Matt Rivera. I'm a student here at UB. I'm studying business and musical theater. My question is, you were talking before we had the event here on campus with the blacks only, whites only signs. And you were talking how in Harvard they had put the tape over the black faculty members. And your colleague said, oh, those people, we should reprimand them for what they did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that going that is kind of limiting our inclusiveness when we react in ways that may kind of target or put members of other communities that are outside of, for instance, say, the black community? Do you think that it targets them and it limits conversation by doing so, you know, going to an extreme where we need to make sure we find out who it is and reprimand them for what they've done? Do you think that it limits some of the ideas and maybe educating those who, you know, are not so inclusive? I just want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, my thoughts are what I've said before. I want to repeat it again. I believe in the First Amendment and the right for people to speak, no matter who they are and no matter how powerless they may seem to be. And I'm very against our dean and our president who wants to punish the people for First Amendment rights. They have the right to speak, the right to say, and even negative things. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And so I'm the one who believes that, you know, everybody should have the right to speak, and they shouldn't be afraid of speaking. And we should stand up and applaud that every single time. And the black students came to me because they created a whole new organization, Black Men and Women. It's the Students for Inclusion, but it came out of Boston, the Black Law Students Association. But they were an integrated group, and they asked me, what should they do? And I told them, you know, do what you have to do to preserve your rights for speech, your rights to the First Amendment. Because that is the first of our constitutional amendments and how important it is for us to happen. And that makes an enormous amount of difference. So I'm when I say I'm on the minority of the faculty, I'm on the minority in the sense that of the view that students have the right to speak and to do what they want to do. They should come to class. They should participate in class. They should take exams. And they should become professors if they want to teach at Harvard or Buffalo or any place else in the country. But I think that's very important to make sure that that happens. And those students come by my office all the time. And when they first came by, they said, you know, I just asked the question. I said, who is your faculty advisor? And they said, you are. Well, wait. Have you discussed this with me? No, but you're the right person. We were sent to you because you stand up for these rights. And I do stand up for the rights because I think those are very important. And the reality is there's black, brown, male, female, white teachers who support my view. We're in the minority, but we're a strong minority about the rights of individuals and how the right to expression matters. And I think that makes a big difference.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Kari Winter. I'm a faculty member here. Thank you for your wonderful comments and for your leadership over many years. I was really struck in your talk about the amount of time you spent talking about how universities are marked, and one is the free speech, and I applaud your stand in favor of free speech, which in a sense happens in a transient public space. It's not a long-lasting, you know, the debate moves from one day to the next. But a different way in which the public space is marked is institutionalized. And you talked about the naming of buildings, the naming of institutes, and so on. And I remember from Jill Lepore's book, New York Burning, she mentions the rather horrific magistrate who led an anti-black pogrom,
yep.
Daniel Horsmanden, having his portrait still hanging in Harvard Law School. So my question is, number one, is his portrait still hanging in Harvard Law School since the publication of her book? And number two, if you think about, again, not the arena of transitory free speech, but the institutionalization of who is remembered and who is erased on university campuses, is there anything you can tell us from your experience at Harvard that would be helpful in rethinking university design?
That's a very good question, and thank you for asking it. There's a similar debate going on with students and faculty and staff about the Royal portrait, because he gave the Royal Institute gave Harvard a lot of money, and one of the professors has the Royal chair, and both his picture has come down. The woman wants her name changed from the royal chair to a different chair. And I think that's a sign of progress going in the right direction. And I think that a lot of people who are given a lot of money expect that, you know, you're going to have a chair, you're going to have a poster, things like that. But places like Harvard, I have to say, it's not just the faculty, but it's the staff and the students are resisting the idea that you're going to have all these folks who we know had slaves, who we know had treated women with disrespect, who we know didn't understand the whole idea of same-sex marriages, how important those things were. And so we have removed a lot of those portraits. And I would say anything that comes to the faculty's attention, we may be in the minority, but the reality is that we have a lot of support when it comes to grappling with what has to be the reality. And it helps when you think of the royal professorship, for one. This was a very progressive white woman who had the royal chair, and she said, you know, I didn't know he was a slave owner, and I wanted to be named to another chair. And that is what the university, first the dean, then the president of the university, did that and made her happy, and that made her be who she is, a very outspoken. She spent a part of her career at Stanford before coming to Harvard, and so she had nothing to lose. She could go back to and do anything that she wanted to do, but she wanted to make a statement about how she should not receive this chair. And Harvard had all this money from the royal chair, but it wasn't enough to overcome the problem that this is a guy who had slaves and thought it was an appropriate thing to do.
Let's take another question from our audience. We'll get a microphone.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Melissa Capen. I am a senior here at the University of Buffalo. I serve the 31,000 students here at UB as I'm the student representative to the University Council, and I also serve the greater 465,000 students of SUNY, where I serve as vice president of the SUNY Student Assembly. Diversity issues are discussed across our campuses and across the nation in both public and private settings. I have a few months left in my roles for these positions, and I know that there are students here who will be fulfilling similar student advocacy positions in the years to come. What advice do you have for myself and for my fellow students in order to bridge the communication gaps between staff, faculty, administration, and students in order to best advocate for our students regarding diversity?
Well, I can say it to you, but just pretend that the faculty and staff are not here. Because I think that you need to walk around the whole university and see what is wrong and what needs to be corrected. And that one thing at a time, you need to talk about, you're a senior, but talk about all the other students, how they are going to, and new admits who are coming here, how important it is for them to take it down. And you're talking about Ronald Reagan said, take that wall down. We need to take that picture down. We need to take that sense of the history of slavery, of sexual oppression, of women being treated differently, of same-sex people being treated with disregard. We need to take that down, and there's no such thing as a university that I think that honors that. That means that we may have to go, and I may have to come back and talk to your governor. I've talked to his on all the time with his brother, but anytime that you want me to talk with Governor Cuomo, I'm ready, willing, and able. I have tenure. I can say or do whatever I want to do, but I think the reality is that it won't all happen in your time, because now you said you're a senior, but the reality is that you can plant the seed, and there are people here who are thinking about coming to the college in Buffalo, who are thinking about spending their time at the university, and I think that is very important. And the same kind of signs, you're going to find resistance. We found resistance at Harvard. There's resistance around the country when people have talked about the fact that, there's a certain admission for black students and a certain admission for white students, and as if they're different. The reality is that, the diversity is this keystone of what makes a faculty great and what makes a student body great and what makes students great and what makes staff great. And I think that is something that has to happen. If you're willing to do that, I think that makes a difference. And you can't do it all while you're here because you're about to graduate. But I think that, there's sophomores and juniors and freshmen who are here as well. And you can plant that seed in them to make them think about this has to be a university that's inclusive and respects the right of everybody to be a part of the community. And I think that makes an enormous amount of difference.
We have another question right over here. And there are two mics, too, so as we get as many of our guests participating as possible while this question's in progress, if you'd like to enter the queue, just raise your hand and we'll get that second microphone to you.
Yes, my name's Dylan Smith.
Sure.
I'm currently in my third year of study here. I am an economics and political science major. And first, I would like to thank you for all your remarks. Being a student who has aspirations of continuing on to law school, it's very heartening. And civil rights is something that's very close to my heart. And with this being an election year, there's a lot of dialogue nationally on a lot of the issues. And I just want to gain your perspective on the issue of very recently the famous author Michelle Alexander came out with remarks criticizing the Clinton administration and their role in tough on crime laws, and the way those laws might have impacted minority groups in the country and leading to mass incarceration. She recently, in an essay, criticized Mrs. Clinton's mm-hmm. connection with the administration, and I would just like to know your perspective on holding a possible candidate for the presidency of the United States accountable for their connections when the U.S. is grappling to understand mass incarceration's role in the civil rights movement in the U.S.
Well, first, it's an excellent question. There's no question about that. And I have met Michelle Alexander, and her husband was a student of mine, and she wasn't. She went to Stanford before writing her terrific books, and I have all of the books that she's written. And I agree with what she has to say. And the reality is that my support for Clinton is that I support any woman who has worked as hard as she's worked. She made it possible for Bill Clinton to be president. You know, all his missteps and all the problems, I shouldn't even be saying this, but it's true. She made it possible for him to be president. She was out front and made it very apparent that she was going to be the first lady, even though she was running the White House, no question about that. Now she has her hands full thinking about running for president. Everything you think of Benghazi, you think about what's happened, but you think about the fact that President Obama had the insight, I think, to appoint her as Secretary of State. First woman to hold that role under him is very important, and that to me was a significant thing. John Kerry has the role, and I think that's very important. She ran and was elected senator, and was a senator in New York, and I think some of the students and former students probably seen her at least once when she was in New York, as she came here. But I'm supporting her because it's time, it's over time for us, this country, to have a woman as president of the United States of America. Michelle says she's not going to run. Elizabeth Warren says she's not going to run yet. You know, I'm waiting, but at some point I want to go to the ballot and vote to see a woman as president of the United States of America, because I think that's the only way we can achieve what I think is true equality of opportunity and not be, in a sense, influenced by the negative commentary that we hear about people. And I, you know, all the negative stuff is very much well taken. I think that, and she has a lot of drawbacks, but I think it's time. I was too young to vote for Shirley Chisholm. I tried to, but I was too young. But I think that her running for president was a sign of a woman, I think she's from Jamaica, a woman who had an international reputation and defiant attitude about politics. That made it happen for me. When I was a kid, when I was in high school, I think it was, and the first person came to me and asked me if I would be active in his campaign, and this is back in Merced, I didn't know the difference between a Republican and a Democrat. And all I knew was that, you know, he was in one party, and he asked me to be part of it. I said, okay, I'll be part of it. And I think the amount to pay was 50 cents, and I was able to pay that, right? But then I didn't know the difference between left and right, Republican, Democrat. Our governor, I voted for Ronald Reagan when he was running for governor in California. Why? Because he was an ideal guy, and it was my first opportunity to vote. So, you know, he seemed like he was doing the right thing. I'm a Republican through and through. There's no question. I'm a Republican. I'm a Democrat through and through. But I've been supporting Republicans and Democrats all my life. But, you know, there's no question about who I am or what I believe in, and I think that turns out to be what is the key going forward.
Do we have another question from our audience? Please, go ahead.
My name's Tirth Patel. I'm a freshman at UB Doing Business. And my question was that you talked earlier about planting seeds for change, that we might not see equality within our campus in our time, but at least I personally feel that a lot of our inequalities at least come from the fact that we like to label each other like black, white, brown, red, whatever. And do you think that, like, in the future, as we try to plant these seeds to reach equality, that these labels will disappear?
I don't think so. I think that As long as I'm not picked up by a cab driver who's driving in New York or Washington or some other place, not because I'm well-dressed and wear and have the money to pay, but because by color of my skin, that person's going to drive by me. And I've talked about that. And, you know, I'm not angry about it. I say, okay, well, take the subway, take the train. Or somebody else will say, and to my credit, it shows that race shouldn't matter that much. There's a white male and female behind me waving for a cab as well. And you know what they did? They stopped the cab and they said, come here. And they said, this is for you. And they knew that the cab driver wouldn't stop for me, but he would stop for them. And he had this sense like, and I said, here's your money, sir. And that made me sense that race shouldn't matter. When I have students come to my office every single day, some of them I've never met before, black, brown, red, yellow, no matter what their race may be, if they have a concern, I'm willing to do it. If they want to clerk somewhere, I'm willing to write a letter. If they want to work at a firm, I'm willing to write a letter. If they want to be involved in social justice, I'm willing to make a phone call. And these are people who I don't know. I don't know how they get my email address or how they find me. They do. And my sense is that, well, you know, I'm willing to do it, whatever I can to make it happen. And that's why I want to make sure that things happens, that people are judging me not on the color of my skin, but on the character and the content of my character, where that matters.
Professor, you've mentioned your commitment to students several times during the afternoon. I know you fund scholarships
Yes.
as well for students. What's it like for you when you meet these people after their education and they come back to you?
It's remarkable. My wife is a wonderful woman. Let me just say that up front. I just want to make it clear. Pam has been my right hand. But I give scholarships to the high school that I went to. And now there are three different high schools in Merced. So I give scholarships to all the high schools. And I don't give it to the smartest students because I know that they're going to get scholarships. They're going to get money to go on to college or graduate school. But so I give it to people who I think have the potential to be successful. And you know what? The biggest surprise came to me when a student came to Harvard Law School and said, Professor Ogletree, my name is blank. I said, oh, it's a nice meeting. He said, no, but I want to tell you, you gave me a scholarship when I was in high school, and then I went to college, and now I'm at Harvard Law School. Thank you. And that, I never expected that. But everywhere I go, I tell people, give money to your high schools, give money to your colleges. That make a big sense. But particularly to your high schools, because then so many people drop out of high school, and they just, not because they fail out of high school, they just drop out of high school because they don't see what's going to be next. And I would say encourage the next generation if you can, because it'll make all the difference in the world.
We have time for a couple of more questions.
Two more questions, Bert.
Two more. Where's our next question?
Hello, my name is Gabrielle. I'm a senior in School of Management. My question is that we have been discussed about spoken prejudice, people who express their opinion, and you think the best way to solve the conflict is to have a dialogue with them. However, there are people around us who has prejudice, who have different opinions, but they don't speak up. However, those unspoken opinions still influence our daily life in a very subtle way. How would you go about to have a dialogue with those people?
It's very hard. It's very hard, no question about that. But I think that you have to insist on a dialogue and make sure that happens. It takes a long time to make that happen because people don't want you to have a contrary point of view to their point of view. But you want to talk about diversity, talk about inclusion, talk about the opportunity for everybody. And I think that makes enormous amount of differences. And I think when you see it, one of the things that I've been noticing around the classes, the people that I select as my teaching assistants and my research assistants are overwhelmingly women. Because they're the quietest people in the classroom, but the smartest people in the classroom. Right? They rarely say things, but they're taking notes, and they're making sure they understand it, and they're doing an incredible job. So I think that the reality is that being part of organizations, it makes a big difference. Being involved in your community makes a big difference. And inviting the community, I don't know how many people here are from the community, but people in the community should come. This should be a public dialogue, a public forum for everybody can come, not just the students, not just the faculty, not just the staff, but people from around the community. And you know what? Sometimes you have to bring people with you because they're saying, no, I didn't go to college. My parents didn't go to high school. They didn't go to college. So we have to make sure that we create opportunities for people more so than are available. And sometimes we have to write about them because it's amazing how many people just don't know our history, our past, our experiences, the people who have suffered, the people who have been successful. And they know about the President of American Express. They know about the this and that president. But there's so many other people who have not, who have done well in community work, and they need to be recognized. My classmate one of my best friends is Kenneth Frazier, and Ken went to Harvard Law School with me, and we have a study group. We've been friends, me and the study group, two women, four men, all black. We've been friends for over 40 years. And every year we have a gathering at somebody's state, wherever. We went to Kentucky, Reggie Thomas took us there, the horse races and things like that. And we said, oh. And he said, well, I want you to see how you breathe the horses. I said, oh, okay. And then he showed us how you breathe the horses. I said, oh, my God, you know, what are we looking at? And we went to the races and things like that. It was very much a wonderful thing. So I think that is good, to have a friendship that's a lifelong friendship, not just one through school, but and it has to be people who otherwise don't have the opportunities that we have, and we need to make sure that we have those opportunities available to us as well.
And we have one final question for the afternoon. Sir?
Yes, my name is Frank Messiah with the NAACP. Would you take a minute and discuss what you found in the Gates case, where he was arrested for breaking into his own home?
Yes.
But you were able to show that the description and that the police gave was totally opposite from what the sergeant said and what had written out, and you were able to go in and refute all of that. Because most people here don't understand some of this issue of race, where white people will see somebody black and see in their hand a weapon. And next to that person would be somebody white who would have the same book in their hand, and they would see a book. And that, if you would discuss that for a while.
I would be happy to. Thank you very much. I think that all the books that I've written are designed to shake people up and make them think about what they're going to do. The book that you have, All Deliberate Speed, that book was a bestseller. It's very interesting. And the same thing has happened with the Gates book. I wrote the book right after him, right after that. It's called The Presumption of Guilt, right? Because they presumed he was guilty, a black man going into a house in a community that only allowed whites live there. And Gates bought this house. And had been to China, was coming back, and flew to New York, and was coming back to home. And that was an amazing thing. But the presumption of guilt I don't know if the book's here or not, but it's an interesting one that tells that story about him. And you know what? And when you talk about this, I'm sure you have 100 stories that people need to hear about how you grew up and what happened and what happened. And this book talks about, at the end, it has a short section on 100, and most of them are men, 100 views about race. And these are men in business, in law, in medicine, in psychiatry. You can't think of a profession that they're not in, and how they all were racially profiled in one respect or another, how significant it was. And they said to me, a lot of them said, we have never told this story before. You know, we just, and I, you know, going to the restaurant, and some of them were mild, like, you know, going to a restaurant, and the partner or the law firm or business firm happened to be black, with all the associates with him who were white. And the person, maitre d', would give the check to one of the white members, not the black guy, the oldest guy who really had was paying for the lunch, right? And they told me these stories, that race still mattered in the year 2009, 2010. You know, it's very recent. And, you end segregation. And Skip Gates, as you know, was born in West Virginia and went to, and then he was that first generation of folks to go to Yale Law School. And he came back to Harvard and created the Institute. Now has a different name, but the first institute he created was the Du Bois Institute, W.B. Du Bois, an African-American male who went to Harvard, who was not happy with all the things that happened to him and how it mattered. And I was influenced by Charles Hamilton Houston. I never met him, but I wanted to have an institution. I created the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice, how important it was for us. But laying out that legacy made a big difference to make sure that people understand that and never will forget it. And if you read the book, it'll have 100 stories of people, and you'll see people, you say, whoa, he said that? Oh, she said that? Wow. And it tells you how much they faced discrimination as growing up, and they kept it to themselves. Whether they're president of American Express, president of Fannie Mae, you can't think of a place where they're not the president or CEO of some organization, but they've made a way to be successful. And I think we need to tell more stories like that to make our children understand it. And I remember having the conversations with my grandparents, and I remember having the dialogue, and this is before many of the students here were born. But I remember as a young kid, my grandfather, we would fish with a cane fishing pole. We'd have a worm or some cornbread on the little, we'd roll up, put on a hook, and we would go to the rivers and the lakes and fish. And for me, I was having fun. For him, it was business, because he had to feed his family. My parents, his family, my children, grandchildren, and we ate everything. And thank God, you know, I'm no longer eating pig and all that other stuff that we ate. But, you know, that was a necessity. We had to eat all those things. And I think that's what we were deciding to do. But I think that we've learned a lot from that. And he taught me that he was not fishing for leisure or for pleasure. He was fishing for food. He was fishing to feed his family. He was hunting for food. He was hunting to feed his family. He was killing squirrels, skunks, whatever you think had any meat in it, even though they had fat and grease and everything else, which caused us all sorts of illnesses. But the reality is that he was responsible for feeding his family, and I think that made an enormous amount of difference.
Professor, we have time for one more question.
Yeah, we missed this young man on several occasions, so we just wanted to end with that.
Hello. My name is Micah Oliver. Thank you for your remarks. I really enjoyed this. My question is, speaking to your days at Stanford, what was a critical point in your student leadership then, and how has that influenced you today?
You know, it's very interesting. I haven't written about this, but I should. There were two incidents at Stanford that made a big difference. One was at Stanford, we had an organization. I was the head of the Black Student Union, replacing the founder of the Black Student Union. And he was still there. He was in the senior year. I was in my freshman year. And I was trying to push this diversity. So what happened? I invited a diverse group of people to come to the Black House. And he heard about it. And he stormed into me and said, look, you do not have white folks or brown folks, anybody other than Black folks, come to the Black House. And that took me by surprise. And that blew me away because I was trying to diversify Stanford. And now the Black House is still largely African-American controlled, but you see a diverse group of students who were involved in the Black House. They do the studies. My professor was a wonderful man, and he taught history, he taught sociology, but knowing him made a big difference for me. And this was a guy, his name was Sinclair Drake, and he, I was just sitting in all his classes, and at one time he says, I want you to deliver my speech in Africa. And I said, oh, Professor Drake, I'm just a sophomore. I don't think I can deliver your speech. No, Charles. I don't want you to deliver it. I want you to give it to somebody else. I want you to deliver it in Africa. That's all, in Tanzania. And so I went there, and it was an amazing experience to, as a young man, to go from Stanford to Tanzania and to see African people and see what they had experienced and how they were moving in the right direction. And I learned a lot from that, and that's what made me, I was debating between, I'm going to be in political science, I'm going to be in history, and Sinclair Drake was a keen leader in that sense and make things happen. And so that was one experience. And the second experience was equally as significant. When I met Angela Davis. She was incarcerated, as you may recall, for trying to break the men out of a judicial proceeding in San Francisco, I think it was. I was trying to figure out, I went to see her at the Women's Detention Center. She was in Palo Alto being held. And I went to see her and I said, you know, I want to raise some money. And she said, Charles, young man, I appreciate that. But I don't need any money. I have international support. I have national support. And you don't need to raise money for me. And I was shocked by that. And so what did we do? We went to Big Daddy McCollum, who worked at the faculty dining room, African-American male. I said, Big Daddy, could you bring a little food we can sell? Because we're putting up a little booth, and we put up a booth, and I had black and brown women and men sitting there selling soup for, I think it was like $5 for a bowl or, you know, chili or whatever it was. And the signs were all over, Free Angela Davis, Free Angela Davis. And we were giving her campaign much money. And now she comes, I see her every summer. She's on Martha's Vineyard. She's a free woman. And I have to say, she has been, to me, a spiritual force of what I need to learn. And that is one of the great things of Stanford. And the third thing and the most important thing is that's where I met my wife. I just wanted to make it clear that I couldn't be where I am. I couldn't do what I wanted to do if it were not for her or for what she was able to do and what she's willing to do and tolerating me. She's made it very possible for me to think about how important it is. And all these opportunities, being on the Board of Trustees, going back to Stanford as an alumnus, I'm going back in about 7 years for our 50th anniversary, and we'll go back again. And I think that will make the university realize how important diversity means to them to have students who are successful as college students and successful in the Board of Trustees and successful in life. And I think that's going to make all the difference in the world.
Professor Charles Ogletree, thank you for this afternoon's conversation.
Great, great. My pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Ogletree is the Harvard Law School Jesse Clemenko Professor of Law, the founding executive director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice. He joins us today as the University at Buffalo's 40th annual Martin Luther King Jr. commemoration keynote speaker. And before we close, some ending remarks now from University at Buffalo President Satish Tripathi.
Thank you, Professor Ogletree, and also, Bert, thank you for this enlightening and very fruitful discussion today here. I want to thank the audience here for being such a participant audience, and thank you for your attention as well as discussion. I want to introduce SUNY trustee, Eunice Lewin, here. Thank you, Eunice, for being here. I said at the start of our conversation today that I believe universities like ours have a vital role to play in providing a forum for dialogue and debate about key issues shaping the world around us. But our responsibilities don't end here. They begin here. Achieving a clearer intellectual understanding is a means to building a better world, starting with our own actions in it. As a university community, we know it is critical for us to actively reaffirm our shared values of diversity, inclusion, and mutual respect, and to live and model those values every day. Thank you all for being part of this conversation today as we keep moving dialogue forward. And look forward to seeing you this evening at the Distinguished Speaker Lecture. Thank you.